You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Yale University and director of the Yale Environmental Humanities Program, Paul Sabin, to discuss his recent book, Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. Also on the program today, Dems negotiate their $3.5 trillion budget, and Manchin reportedly says, I'm not on board with any more than $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, the House and Senate Democrats clash over both the spending and the taxes on that bill. Meanwhile, extended and expanded unemployment ended for 7.5 million people, even though we are still 5 to 6 million jobs shy of where we were pre-pandemic. And Joe Biden seemingly did nothing to stop it. Department of Justice claims it will protect Texas women seeking abortions, but they can say nothing about ensuring its access. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem orders a restriction on abortion medications. And as we near the Republican endgame regarding abortions, Mexico's Supreme Court decriminalizes abortion. Speaking of abortion, Governor Abbott claims that Texas will get rid of rape. He also signs one of the most restrictive voting laws in the nation. Vaccinations now reach 75% of adults in this country, at least one vaccination. Meanwhile, Delta continues to burn through the states. Idaho, the latest now to have its medical system on the teetering on the brink. Lastly, early voting underway in the California recall. If you're out there in California, get your vote, your no vote in ASAP. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are back. Emma is on vacation this week. I am back from both the Labor Day and the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah holiday. I'm a little bit under the weather, not going to lie, but we will endeavor to persevere, as it were. A lot of things happening. The next couple of weeks, and we've been sort of pointing to this for quite some time, and I would have anticipated this might have been resolved by now. But the next couple of weeks, in terms of what happens with this Democratic reconciliation budget bill, is probably going to dictate, in many ways, it's going to set the trajectory for our politics for the next couple of years. The difference between $4 trillion of new spending, including an expansion of Medicare, both in terms of what services it provides and who is eligible for Medicare, shoring up Medicaid, providing home health aides, providing an extension on the child tax credits, greening our economy to some respect. All of these things are huge. And if they happen, it's going to be one of the biggest bills of material benefit for the American public in decades. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we need to see where it lands. But we could be looking at something that rivals, you know, not quite Medicare and Medicaid, but certainly anything since then. And or the whole thing could unravel, and or we could get some, you know, half measure, which is going to I would imagine provide some benefit for some people, create a political liability that is far greater than I would imagine, you know, the benefits from it. So we'll see in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow on the program, Ryan Grimm is going to join us. They have the Intercept has a blockbuster report on Joe Manchin's daughter, and there's been some reporting on her business practices, but you know, there's been a lot of talk about comparing Joe Biden to FDR or LBJ or this and that, and I'll let historians, you know, sort of sort that out better. But if you're Joe Biden and you are aware of the report in The Intercept, and we'll be talking about this tomorrow, seems to me you have some leverage. And frankly, the corruption that I think is involved in, you know, Joe Manchin's family, extended family, and just even from what we heard from that no labels conversation he had, I am all for a lack of corruption in our government, but I'm also all for politicians leveraging the corruption of another politician to get them to vote for things that they don't want to vote for. I don't know how to express that in any other way. I don't really care. This is not the set of The West Wing. And what's his face? What's that guy's name? Who wrote it? The West Wing?
Sorkin.
Yeah, he's not here. So there seems to me that there's a lot of opportunity for Joe Biden to play hardball. That's what hardball is. Hardball is not making a speech. Hardball is saying, here are the assets I have. Here are the liabilities you have. How am I going to turn this into a win for me? Meanwhile, back in Texas, and there is now, you know, there's increasingly people are finding arguments as to what could make this law unconstitutional. There was apparently some challenges that came out of Boston about the ability of the government to, in some way, create surrogates to uphold laws by lawsuit when people had no even pretense of a damage. I could sue someone who is aiding and abetting an abortion in Texas, and there is no way in a million years one could show that I have suffered a damage in the context of tort law. One of the things that is even that is most odious, although I think the whole thing is odious, is that the Texas law does not make an exception for rape or incest. And Greg Abbott was asked about this as the governor of Texas, and he's got a solution.
Governor, regarding the heartbeat bill, why force a rape or incest victim to carry a pregnancy to term?
It doesn't require that at all because obviously it provides at least 6 weeks for a person to be able to get an abortion. And so for one, it doesn't provide that. That said, however, let's make something very clear. Rape is a crime, and Texas will work tirelessly to make sure that we eliminate all rapists from the streets of Texas by aggressively going out and arresting them and prosecuting them and getting them off the streets.
I mean, is he implying that Texas has not been doing this? That, no. that there was some question as to whether rape was a crime in Texas up until this moment that this abortion bill was passed?
Look, we'll be on our best behavior about the rapes if you just let us do the abortion bill.
I mean...
We'll start investigating them real good. Like.
And just the like insanity of him, like, I'm going to turn up my volume a little bit here and I'm going to say this forcefully and you'll hear the rising applause as we say that rape is a crime. And we're going to, by darn it, get rid of rape in Texas. odd that he did not address incest either, but presumably they're going to get rid of incest now too. I mean, this is lunacy. It's lunacy. It's lunacy that it's lunacy to me that you're like, you could actually read and look, I don't care about Joe Biden. And I imagine if one was actually in close proximity to him, you'd find him insufferable. But the idea that the New York Times is writing long think pieces on the fact that Joe Biden brings up his dead son, and someone like Greg Abbott is allowed to actually go out in public without having so much negative media and attention that he can, you know, actually walk from place A to B is just, I'm sorry. It's lunacy. It's lunacy. I don't know how anyone right now in mass media could be doing anything other than writing articles about how Greg Abbott is a lunatic. This is like that video of the guy with the mask who's growling on the airplane. We'll play that later in the program. One last clip, too, that we should get to. Do we have time? We'll do this quickly. We know in California, there is an ongoing recall election. The returned ballots so far, early ballots, seem to be favoring Democrats. Remember, and if you listen to the interview I did with Erwin Chemerinsky yesterday, there's good reason to believe that were Newsom essentially kicked out of office, that it would be unconstitutional insofar as it's going to take a majority, I think it is, of recall voters to vote him out. But someone can get elected with 19%. I mean, if Larry Elder actually gets elected, he could win the governorship with 19%. Newsom is not allowed on the ballot. So his election is you need to win the majority. But Elder's election, if he wins, you need to win the plurality. You see the problem there. In Newsom's election, if he loses 60 to 40%, let's say, 60% say we want him out, 40% we want him in, his 40%, those 40% of voters have less of a say on what is going to happen in terms of the outcome of the election than the 19%, theoretically, who would vote for Elder. But the at least the polls now are showing that Elder may be that the recall provision may be in jeopardy. And again, Gavin Newsom, I don't have too many great things to say about Gavin Newsom. But the best thing I can say about him and the most assured I can say is better than Larry Elder. Here is former President Donald Trump on Newsmax. Starting the cri de coeur in California.
We've got the recall election coming up in less than a week. It's actually happening as we speak. The polls appear to show Newsom looks safer at this point. Larry Elder is the man that could take it from him. What do you think happens in California?
Well, it's probably rigged. They're sending out all ballots. It's all the ballots are, you know, mail out, mail in ballots. In fact, I guess you even have a case where you can make your own ballot. When that happens, nobody's going to win except these Democrats. So, you know, look, they're very good. The one thing they're good at is rigging elections. So I predict it's a rigged election. Let's see how it turns out.
I don't know what's going on with this. Like, a little bit of like a going on, but there it is. They're already, you know, laying the groundwork in California. Yeah, a little subtle. But get out and vote right now. Donald Trump apparently believes that you can make your own ballots. So if you can, go ahead and do that. But otherwise, why don't you get an official ballot?
Yeah, I would take an official one, probably.
Yep. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Paul Sabin. Folks, you've heard me talk about Quip, toothbrush company. They make, basically a whole line of dental hygiene products that make it easier for maintain good dental hygiene habits. mouthwash hasn't changed in over 140 years. Most brands are still selling big, bulky bottles that are mostly full of water and alcohol. That's why the oral care experts at Quip created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need, less that you don't, and it comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that is 100% recyclable. Now, you know that Quip has the electric toothbrush. You know that they have the flosser, which I think is probably one of the greatest, the reusable flosser, which is one of the greatest inventions I think I've ever seen. And I can't stop talking about that. They also have Quip gum that comes in a reusable dispenser, sort of like a Pez thing. Well, their four times concentrate mouthwash has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the stinging alcohol you'll find in other rinses. You can get a customizable subscription. You can get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch for a complete oral care routine. You pair it with your Quip electric toothbrush. I've got one. Saul's got one. Milo's got one. All my kids have it. Well, both my kids. We got a refillable flosser. Saul wants one of those too. He's pining after mine, and they're great tasting, good for you gum. All of this, the mouthwash makes a great compliment. And you go to getquip.com/majority5, the number 5, right now, and you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-day dose supply of Quip's four times concentrated formula at getquip/majority5. That's spelled getquip.com/majority5. Quip, it's the Good Habits Company. All right, want to welcome to the program Professor of History at Yale University, Director of the Yale Environmental Humanities Program, and author of his most recent, Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. Paul Sabin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
I found your book fascinating, in part because one of the things that I regularly do, and I used to do a radio show with a trial lawyer, is to go to these mass tort conferences, and very often I get an opportunity to sit down with public interest lawyers.
Okay.
And so, like, I am very familiar with the type of skepticism of government, and really right now, right, we're seeing an enormous amount of skepticism towards government, and we're finding, you know, we're seeing what the potential real problems are with that in the functioning of an emergency. But let's start with where we were post-war in terms of this perspective, which was, I think, you know, fundamentally different than where we were probably pre-New Deal in terms of...
Yeah. I mean, so Public Citizens, the book is really about the journey from, in some ways, the journey from Lyndon Johnson to Ronald Reagan, and trying to make sense of the changing attitudes towards government over that time period. And so it's really important to start with the, you know, the period that you're talking about between the 50s and early 60s, when you have a kind of the federal government playing a kind of managerial role in the economy and brokering between business and labor, and managing different sectors of the economy, including trucking and energy and airlines, communications. It's a period of time when there's one economist who writes about it as the system of countervailing powers. And there's this idea of balance between these different parts of the political economy. And so what my book is talking about is really the rise of liberals speaking out against that system and seeing it as problematic. And so it's going against, I guess, an interpretation that describes the sort of the end of what some people call the New Deal order, this period in the post-war period. When the government was doing big things, it was building dams and highways and urban renewal, lots of big interventions. And how we got, you know, how that sort of fell apart during this period. And so, you know, so I'm writing about how this wasn't just the conservatives that were attacking this, but also the liberals that were increasingly upset with the sort of unaccountable power of the federal government.
And we should say, you know, when we look at around that period, the late 50s, early 60s, polls that looked at faith in government was something like 3/4 of the population had trust in government, and now it's down to like 1/4.
Yeah. So I mean, you have the government coming out of the war and out of the New Deal, the sense of the government as the protector of democracy, the representer of the public. So part of what I'm writing about is the idea during that time period that the government could represent the public interest, and that it, you know, there was an idea in the New Deal that you'd create these executive agencies, the Securities Exchange Commission, others, and those agencies would be able to represent the public and sort of, as I was saying, sort of broker in the interest of the public, so you also have agencies like the Tennessee Valley Authority, and the historian Henry Cominger talks about that as being sort of this great example of how government could be was superior to business, and the government could manage in the public interest. And we had to, you know, it was the epitome of American democracy. So part of what I'm, you know, talking about is how that sort of falls apart.
And we should say it was Galbraith, right? That referred to the
Galbraith. Yeah, the countervailing powers, exactly.
And so, okay, and so this is the story of how we got from that 75% to 25% in many respects. And it is, I mean, I think, like, you know, other people have told the conservative story, and surely that has a, that's a big part of that answer.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
But there's also this other part, and it's interesting to me in terms of, like, how it has an interplay between anti-monopolists and socialists, or people who are more socialistically inclined, I guess, in some respects. But let's talk about how where you start to see, and part of what you write is both I think a history and an intellectual history in some respects, and you see some of this skepticism, I guess, of government starting with Jane Jacobs, who just talk about that just as a, and then we can talk about the evolution of that movement.
Yeah, so I open the book with three strong characters that names are familiar to many, Jane Jacobs and Rachel Carson and Ralph Nader, and talk about them as public intellectuals of the early 1960s, liberals who sort of turn on the government. And so Jane Jacobs famously, you know, wrote this book, The Death and Life of American Cities. And the first sentence is, you know, that this book is an attack on planning and planners, essentially. And so she is reacting to people like Robert Moses, you know, the great city builders who were remaking the New York, New York area with the highways and parks and bridges and other types of things. And she was reacting to that. It's really the, part of what's happening is in the post-war period, the federal government has grown in scale and it's sort of using technology and science to increasingly manipulate the American landscape and rebuild it around the automobile. Carson speaks up about pesticides, the mass spraying of pesticides across the nation. And Nader, his first major intervention is around the automobile as well, in terms of automobile safety. But it's they're you know, speaking up. And then so part of what I talk about in the book is how it goes from these ideas, these intellectual ideas, which actually even embedded, you know, even represented in the Kennedy administration. There's a report when Kennedy comes into office about the agencies kind of talking about how the agencies aren't doing what people wanted them or thought they should do. So I start with these big public intellectuals, and then it's how does it become then an organizational movement by the end of the 60s and into the 70s?
And then you really do focus on Nader. And I should also say at this point too, what I found really interesting was there is a theme that we see that comes out of this era. And it is like sort of adjacent to the hippie movement, I guess. But it is a libertarian streak, if you will, on the left on some level. and or an individualistic
an anti-institutional concern about the bureaucracy. You don't want a famous Mario Savio, you don't want to be a cog in the machine, that kind of thing. Exactly.
And, I mean, just even thinking about like Adam Curtis's documentaries on like what happened in that era was the notion of individuating yourself that took place on the left,
right,
as an expression of nonconformity, I guess, on some level, and getting away from that. But so now Ralph Nader, a guy with basically three different, I guess, profiles, right? The consumer advocate, and then sort of the broader citizen advocate, maybe, and then in 1980 as like sort of a third party guy. But let's talk about his development and what the implications of that were.
Sure. Yeah. So Nader is, in many ways, I use him as a central character, a thread through the book, because he makes the journey from being a public intellectual with Unsafe at Any Speed, his expose of the auto safety and the automobile, sort of the close alliance between the auto companies and the government, to them becoming an organizational entrepreneur. And he creates, dozens of organizations, starting in the late 60s, and leads, encourages, young people particularly to investigate lots of government agencies and do lots of exposés. And he kind of runs through this, he's a thread, through this. So yeah, Nader's really a fascinating character. Grew up, in Northwestern Connecticut as a child of a restaurant, family that had immigrated, Lebanese immigrants, and were very committed to sort of the town meeting life and small business and that idea. And I think that really carries through Nader's philosophy through his whole life, including his antagonism to big business, his sense of a belief in the American ideals of competitiveness and small town democracy, participation. And so he tries to bring a lot of that to, the larger, larger arena, certainly.
Well, let's talk about where the line was drawn, or was it, or, that, between the idea of our government has been corrupted by business on some level, or our government is imperfect, or that government is problematic, or having that much power is problematic. Because he was also, it would not be accurate to call him of the socialist left.
No, he's clearly, was against sort of the isms, and I think that's an important part of this sort of public interest movement that I'm writing about, is that it was not kind of came after, well, it's really antagonistic both to state sponsored socialism, and to unfettered capitalism. And it criticized, the socialist model because it had a critique of bureaucracy, essentially. It was a critique of institutions, large institutions, and that included bureaucracies, that would become unaccountable, and oppressive to their citizens. And so someone like Nader was the embrace of citizens as outside watching over the government was a rejection both of the corporations and their power, but also the unfettered power of the state itself.
But was it, so if FDR said that, essentially something, I'm paraphrasing, but we are the government, mm-hmm. that we are the government. Did Nader's tack change that formulation in that, like,
I think that's a great question. I think what Nader and others would say is that the government should be us. But it's not us, because of the way it's been captured and the way that has these internal dynamics, that don't lead to it representing the people. And so therefore we need to create this. It's just a wonderful name. The public interest movement is saying essentially that outside of the government is where the public interest, the flame of the public interest, has to be curated, has to be safeguarded, to make sure that the government is representing it. So I think there's a strong faith in government, the belief in the government and the Congress is representing the people, but also a sense of disappointment and failure, and a need for that the system needs to be held accountable with a sort of a permanent outside watchguards.
And to what extent would I think people can understand how that framing can both, can cut both ways,
yeah.
Right? I mean, because My assessment of what the public interest is, holding the government to account for that, is very different from other people's notion right. of what the public interest is. And that seems to me open. You're opening up once you're identifying or you're saying that the problem is structural with the government, as opposed to its relationship with, let's say, big money. And the implication being that you need a permanent outside institution because you can never fix that relationship with big money. It starts to become a little bit problematic and up to anyone's sort of idea of what the public interest is.
Yeah, well, I think that, so if we were thinking about some of the weaknesses or limitations of the movement, one of them would be this issue, which is that they believe that they held the idea, they held the public interest, but then, their antagonists, conservative law firms and other groups, also organized and all of a sudden they were claiming that they represented the public interest and they were suing to protect property rights and against regulations and all that. And then as the judiciary has shifted over, the last, 40 years or so, it's become increasingly unsympathetic to the liberal public interest groups and more sympathetic to the conservative ones. And it's just shown that, as a mode of, social change, that relying on, sort of external litigation and advocacy, has serious limitations as opposed to trying to, control the institutions of power, get involved with politics as messy and compromised as they are, to try to build a larger social movement. I think there's been a realization that is necessary.
Let's talk about the other types of groups, because it had never occurred to me that you hear so many of the defense funds, that those were all almost in some way incubated or modeled after what Nader did. And to be clear, and will you outline in a sort of like a material way what Nader did through these citizens? I mean, I think people who sure. have listened to some of the past times where I've gone to these tort conferences, we get a little bit of that. But will you outline what their methodology was and
sure,
then
yeah,
how
yeah.
this was adopted by other organizations.
Yeah, that's great. So I'd say, first is two things. One is the whole idea of the defense fund. It was inspired in some ways by the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund, and seeing it, the civil rights litigation and civil rights movement, and those attacks and critiques of the government, and seeing that, we could create these types of organizations. So you get the Environmental Defense Fund, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. They're all modeled on that, and also maybe the ACLU. And so at the end of 1967 into 1968, Nader and some of these other folks decide to start creating organizations that could litigate and that could sue the government and try to rein in and watch over the agencies. And the other thing that was motivating some of this is the Vietnam War and the sense that the growing distrust of government that was stimulated by the war itself and the anti-war movement, the sense of government might be lying and misrepresenting and misleading. So these are all the environment of it. So as Nixon comes into office, the liberals out of power, groups like the Ford Foundation, fund a whole network of these organizations. And what they do is start litigating. So there are tremendous numbers of lawsuits against the agencies. And they also start investigating. So Nader particularly did a whole series of investigations of clean air, of water pollution, of air pollution, of pet toxic pesticides, all these different things. And they were investigations of agencies. And you can tie them directly to the major legislation of the early 1970s, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And they had a big impact on how those laws were structured in terms of the role of citizens in holding government and businesses accountable, and also the way that Congress set the rules very stringently so that the agencies would not have as much latitude for action. They wanted to create, they didn't trust the agency. There's a fundamental distrust in the legislation of the early 70s that is stimulated by these types, these investigations and this litigation.
Wait, I'm sorry. Will you explain that last part? That the legislation did not give agencies that came out of the 1970s wide parameters.
Well, it empowered the agencies, but it gave them very specific goals and mandates. And the idea was that you couldn't necessarily just trust the agency, but you had to really be very directive of the agency. So they're much more much tougher emphasis on enforcement, because under Johnson there'd been a kind of they'd embrace like conferences. Like there'd be, we're going to have a conference of the interested parties, and we're going to sort of discuss how we can improve the air, and we'll work on it, and we'll try to solve it. And there was a sense that this is broken. The government, they need to pass laws. There was one guy working on clean water, David Zwick. He says we have to pass laws that are government proof, with the idea that the government, you couldn't let the government, undermine the law itself.
And so that was that, at that time it was more get together with business and labor and figure out what the solution is. And now it's like, well, the solution is to make it less. I mean, the irony, of course, is that we are, I don't know if it's months or maybe a couple of years away from, the Supreme Court essentially saying that Congress is not specific enough, in their requirements of these agencies, and essentially allowing, preventing these agencies from doing just about anything that requires some measure of expertise. Congress.
Right. This is a whole complicated area of administrative law, certainly. But I think that they did give agencies discretion, and the agencies used discretion kind of coming out of the 70s to interpret laws and try to implement them. But it is important to, in contrasting the early 70s laws with the late 60s laws, there was a much more directive nature of congressional action and a sense of holding a higher standard, greater mandates, and making them much tougher. So there's less wiggle room.
And so coming out of that era, where does that take us? Because somehow we get from a strengthening of, one interpretation is, that you make it government proof. The other is that government is taking more, is being more assertive and being more specific about what the outcome should be. And then we head into the 80s and, the idea that you're running against the existence of the government in many respects, even if you don't necessarily lead that way, is what brings Reagan to power. And then also, it seems to me, Clinton to power.
Well, so part of what I'm trying to illuminate in this 1970s period is how the liberals were divided, in the sense that they were both seeking an active government, but they were also devoting themselves to attacking and criticizing and breaking up some of the elements of government power. And that includes things like the Freedom of Information Act. We're going to force open the government secrets and show what's been going on, and other types of procedural interventions that would, environmental impact statements that the federal government would have to demonstrate that, big infrastructure projects would not have an undue impact on the environment. These are all distrust, aspects of distrust of the government. So they were both passing laws that increased agency power, clean air, clean water, occupational safety and health. So these regulations of the early 70s, but then they were also trying to break apart the close alliance with the with businesses. And at the end of the 70s, you start the deregulation, deregulation of trucking and airlines and communications. That whole movement starts, and liberals are very active in that, because they start to see, people like Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and Nader and Carter, and they're all talking about how regulation has become. Essentially, the government has become part of the cartel, essentially, and they need to have more competition. So I guess part of what I'm saying is it's more complicated coming out of the 70s. But then Reagan comes in, and he's so extreme in his attack on the government, because and what he does is he takes only the criticism and he drops any of the embrace of the government's positive vision. So what was different between Reagan and Nader is Nader wanted the government to do things, but he wanted them to do it better and to be accountable. Reagan just didn't want them to do it, and he was trying to undermine, he took it so far as well. So you end up in this thing in the situation in the early 80s, which I call sort of a great stalemate, in which liberals are defending the government, the conservatives are attacking it. And it's a very unnuanced idea of how government operates the nature of the politics.
Would Nader and Naderites and the movement that he represented at that time, how would they have Would they have characterized their position towards government as this is something that needs improvement versus this is something that is problematic in and of itself? I mean, because clearly Reagan, right, took the problematic and just ran with that.
Yeah,
government's
yeah.
the problem. I mean, I think literally.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not totally sure of the distinction you're making, but in the sense that it needs improvement is that that they embrace the legitimate aims of the government, and but that they need to be done better. They are absolutely on that side, but they clearly thought that it needed reform, and they could cite examples of things. You could think of nuclear testing, urban redevelopment, and those consequences, dams that were being built that maybe shouldn't be built, the highways going through neighborhoods. There's lots of examples of government doing things that were destructive and harmful, and you could point to those and say, we got to stop the government. We have to stop them. They're causing these various crises. But at the same time, they believed they believed in government as a potential representer of the public interest and that it could be turned to the proper aims. They believe that that could be possible and should be possible.
Was there any, reflection upon that maybe there was a rhetorical, that the framing of this from a political standpoint, or there was overconfidence that there was already a sort of like a public consensus that government, generically speaking, is good, but we need to fix certain aspects of it? I mean, I just like, you know, you there was a report about the abuse of unemployment insurance. I can't remember how many billions of dollars. And but it was largely like the abuse of unemployment insurance was, international criminal cabals that had figured out how to game the system because it was set up, it expanded to a lot of people who were not on the rolls before, people who are in gig economy and this and that. And so that money's being sucked out of the government. And something like that in these days will ultimately be weaponized, if it hasn't already, by the right. At the same time, there's a story in the Wall Street Journal today or yesterday about, some of the big chain stores like the Walmart and Target losing billions of dollars worth of goods that have been resold on Amazon by the criminal syndicate. Nobody criticizes the failure of business to which, we're all paying for that, right? I mean, they suffer, loss, they just pass it on to the consumer in the same way that theoretically the government does in terms of our tax dollars, theoretically. I mean, but we never hear the concept of business being attacked as being like, there's so much, it's rife with fraud, of course it is. But we hear that in the context of government. This is not a one-to-one matchup with what Nader was interested in, but it's still part of that rhetorical framework.
Well, I think there are a couple important points there. One is that I discussed in the book is the way in which government's being often held up against an ideal that is unrealistic, and that we'd all be much better off if we thought about government as something that is doing the best it can, and it's going to have some. So you go back to the under Obama, the big investment recovery act, there's a lot of focus on this, on one company, Solyndra, and what happened with the, this money was lent to Solyndra and the money was wasted. What happened to all, but actually it was a tiny fraction of the investment capital that was being put into renewables. And actually it was remarkably successful. And you see this, plummeting in prices that's been going on across renewables. That's a solar and wind. That's a product of government investment in the U.S. and China and Germany and elsewhere. And so actually it's been quite successful, but as you point out, one item of waste can be held up. But we have to think about government as a flawed but worthy entity that is not necessarily going to be perfect, but it's the best we got, and we need to try to make it better while also, doing what it can do.
I mean, the Solyndra is a perfect example. You never hear a venture capital fund being criticized for the, 20 misses, because that's,
you don't have any misses, you're not taking any risk.
That's part of their business model, right?
Yeah,
and the other five are supposed to pay for the 20 plus.
Right. Well, I think the thing that I just want to say, going back to that period in the late 70s, I think we need to look at Carter again a little bit and think about what he was trying to do versus what Reagan did afterwards. But Carter was trying, in my view, was trying to integrate these criticisms of the government from the early 70s, the sense that government had to be improved, had to be reformed, but at the same time, we need government. So he was trying to articulate a positive vision for government. We were going to regulate, we're going to try to protect the air, we're going to clean water, all these various things. But at the same time, we're going to improve it. And so he tried to use cost benefit analysis to evaluate policies to figure out and make sure that they were worth doing. But it was a real challenge to sell that. And I think that was the failure of the Carter administration in many ways domestically. And he was held up, and I think there was a lot of frustration internally that people like Nader and others on the outside, the public interest movement, they were so accustomed to criticizing the government that they criticized Carter. And really some of them abandoned who was their natural ally and weren't really interested in supporting his reelection. And it was, that's a real was a limitation, I think, of the public interest movement, not really understanding what their relationship might be to a successful, liberal administration.
Has there been a successful rhetorical gambit to address that nuance? I mean, is there one?
I think if you go through all these different, particularly the Democratic presidents over the years, you think of Clinton's effort to reinvent government, and they had Obama also tried to bring back
Clinton, it seemed to me, if you're going to make a binary breakdown of where he fell closer to Reagan. Then he did.
I'm not sure I would actually agree with that. But, it's interesting. You go back, he had this declaration where he said that, the era of big government is over. And I think people make a lot of that. I see it as if you read that in context, he talks about how the era of big government is over, but he talks about but government still has to do things to make people's lives better. And I think what he was trying to do is really, he was coming out of the 70s. He was a child of this public interest period and was critical of the New Deal agencies. Hillary had worked in public interest organizations. So they were really imbued with that. And so they were critical of the idea of powerful, autonomous, unaccountable bureaucracies, and they wanted to have a more flexible, efficient idea of government. So my view is that Clinton was trying to do this thing where you would build trust in the government by showing that you were making it more efficient and effective. That was his belief. You could argue about whether it was a good idea or the right approach, but I think that was what he was trying to do. He was pro-government ultimately.
I don't know. I mean, I think if 30 years later, there's only one thing that people can remember. It's the era of big government is over. That to me is,
I'm just saying, going back, if you go back and read the Reinventing Government report, that Gore was behind, and the rhetoric is really critical of the New Deal agencies. And it's talking about trying to create a new version of government that has a more customer focus, more efficiency, flexibility, so that it'll be, and it's talking about, they use the language of how can we build trust in government? And the way we're going to do it is by doing what I'm telling you, of trying to show that we both need government and we have to improve it. And I think the way that Clinton's remembering just shows how difficult it is to try to carry out that message. Very, very hard.
I guess you got to be careful about the top line in that speech.
I think that's true.
I don't know. It seems to me. And Obama came in and employed Cass Sunstein as one of the primary drivers of that idea of streamlining government. But this is a guy who has proven to be hostile to government regulation and again has this sort of same, not necessarily same, but he is of that libertarian streak, it seems to me.
It would be great to get him on and talk about it. To say, is someone like Sunstein, genuinely hostile to government, or is he trying to, do what I'm describing, which is create an effective and efficient government to maximize the investment, you know, the public's resources in serving the public ends. I mean, I think it's interesting more recently the way cost benefit analysis has been turned around with the social cost of carbon to be a justification for intervention and government action. And now it's, you know, striking that the conservatives don't like cost benefit analysis when it comes to taking account of the, you know, the cost of carbon dioxide.
But I guess I'm asking, like, what is the inefficiencies like? I mean, how problematic have the inefficiencies been? I mean, I guess that's my point, is that, like, you know, when you lead with we're going to fix the inefficiencies of government, it seems to me that the argument is that government has been failing as opposed to, you know, in its execution of plans, as opposed to we simply have not been the wrong people have been. Or the wrong agenda has government's been used for the wrong agenda, right? I mean, like, I say, we can talk about the inefficiencies in the unemployment benefits that were put out. Certainly, it was inefficient because we had no apparatus to get money to people who were, you know, Uber drivers or, we had no, but it also halved poverty. It basically kept people afloat. And if you buy into the inefficiency argument, then it's easier to do what just happened a day ago.
I think that efficiency is not can't be the sole shouldn't be the sole goal, and lots of programs that it can be efficient even if not every dollar is being spent ideally. It's maybe the most efficient way to accomplish the larger goal. I mean, I think if you go back to
what other way have we halved poverty? Like, what are we comparing the efficiency to?
Yeah, right? No, I'm supportive of those policies. But if you go back and think about the government's role in the late 70s, one example of that is in the regulatory arena related to communications. Part of the reason, there was the idea that AT&T had too much power and that the government was basically enforcing the monopoly and that needed to be broken up into the baby bells and then eventually the wireless companies. And part of what happened was we created a more competitive, communications system and network that is part of why we have a lot of the devices and things that we have today that may not have been a product of an AT&T only controlled system. So I think that there's so that was one element of it, was the liberals among them kind of criticizing the way that the government was basically enforcing the monopolistic control by companies of certain sectors of the economy. Now, you can argue that that also can be very problematic. And Enron is a great example of that, where they deregulated the electrical markets and did it very badly and created sort of new ways for companies to leverage their power. So it's complicated.
I would argue airline deregulation also had a similar unfavorable outcome.
It's complicated. It's very complicated, and I don't even think deregulation is necessarily the best word, because it's really sort of a new kind of regulation.
Exactly.
And different
I guess that's part of my argument, is that when we start talking about big government, we use the words big government, where we use the words efficiencies and stuff like this in the context of government, it obscures really what it seems to me is the upside of government, which is that it's a manifestation of what we want in terms of outcomes. And that's what I think is.
Well, I mean, I think you, it's okay. So here's an example, that you can, thinking about public health dollars, recently there's been a lot of attention to the approval of the Alzheimer's drug. And this is not my area of expertise, but there's a lot of concern that a drug was approved for use that is going to be wildly expensive and not bring a lot of results. And so I think that the efficiency attitude towards that would say, we should think about how the government is spending its public health dollars and decide whether this somewhat unproven drug is a great way to spend, billions and billions of dollars, or instead whether that money should be spent to some other public health purpose. And I think that is the kind of legitimate question that we can raise about the expenditure of public dollars.
I couldn't agree more. I would frame that as, here is a corporate assault on our government that is inhibiting making good choices.
Well,
we
that,
see that
yeah.
There's a lot of stories coming out
that's
of the
part
EU.
Of it. That's part of it.
All right. Well, it's a fascinating conversation. Paul Sabin, the book is Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Finish things up. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. It got a little bit, little spicy. I mean, I think it's really, I am of the mindset, and I think I have great appreciation. I think people know this of both public interest law and of private interest law in terms of regulating corporate behavior. And actually, you know, one of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about was, over the course of the past 40 years, the Supreme Court has continued to inhibit, progressively inhibited folks' ability to curtail the power of corporations and in some respects of government through the court system, which I think is very problematic. But I also think that when you get too nuanced, I think Clinton was, you know, at best, even if I want to just sort of be generous today, too nuanced. I do not think coming out and saying the era of big government is over, knowing that's the headline, and then saying, but if you check in on our report that we're going to write 9 to 12 months from now, you're going to see, it's by the vice president, that on page 23, we're pretty explicit about how we think government should exist and can do good things. I think from a political standpoint, it's okay to say that government is not perfect because nothing's perfect. But its potential for good far greater than any other single institution in our society, it seems to me.
Yeah, and being preoccupied with efficiency as the government is expanding its incarceration sort of capacities.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, like, I mean, and measured against what? Like, what other entity has attempted to do these type of things? None. So to say inefficient, you need to compare it to what? It turns out maybe that inefficiency is really what doing those things is. We'll have more on this for, I don't know, the next several years at least. So tune in. If you're leaving us from Peacock, we will see you tomorrow and after. For those of you sticking around, thank God we got those folks out of here, because I got to tell you, I am not well. And it is not that I am suffering from a psychological issue that developed over the course of Friday's show, last Friday's show, when I had to bare my shoulders and my guns. Oliver Wendell Holmes on the IM says, considering the wildly fluctuating numbers on the infrastructure bill, I think the question on everyone's mind is, which will have a higher price tag, infrastructure or Sam's therapy bill from last Friday? It was not my favorite thing to do, but it was fun. But more importantly, it was very, very successful as a fundraiser. Our GoFundMe page, which will be live until tomorrow morning at bit.ly/MRAfghan with the A capitalized, we'll put a link into it, has raised $27,000, $27,092. What is it called? Super chat? Is that what it's called? Yep. Our super chat thing in YouTube lags. But from what I can tell, we raised over $1,500, maybe $1,545. 1429 through Super Chat and 115 through Super Stickers. I don't know what that means, but
Is that a Twitch thing?
No, that's on the YouTube analytics. Oh. I mean, what's fascinating is that, we don't really do Super Chats on this show. I mean, if people do them, they're much appreciated, but we don't generally make a call for Super Chats. So the line goes like this, and then all of a sudden it just goes like that for that day. We've raised over $28,000. There have been some incredibly generous donations by people. You can see them on, let me just talk about the top donations. But with that said, look, if you're hurting financially and you give $5, in many respects, that's more generous than if you have the ability to drop a couple $100 and you don't even notice it. I mean, but we had something like 300 donors. It was really impressive. Our top donors: David Siegel, Michael Hamler, Sunset Lake, Zabada. Thank you guys. That's nice. And then Anonymous. This person, Anonymous.
Going off.
Yeah, they gave a lot. Multiple things. And then,
I mean, they're taking time, a break from hacking into databases.
Exactly. John Benjamin and Real Glitterbox. I think that's the top eight, I guess.
That's not John Benjamin and the Glitterbox?
No, it's John Benjamin and Real Glitter Bear, XXX. I don't know. John Benjamin, no XXX there. But I just... thank you, people. Maybe we'll do an annual Suns Out, Guns Out because of it. And believe me, I never in a million years thought I would be saying those words. But thank you to Ronald Reagan, who has been, I want to say, encouraging me to do that. But really, it's just been nagging and harassment. But he also did send the Thanos shirt.
Really wouldn't have worked without the Thanos shirt, I think.
We have somewhere in the office I can't remember what it was. There was another one that, like, and on the seventh day, God made these or something like that. I can't remember what it was. So thank you to everybody who participated. Much appreciated. We're going to go into the fun half. I will tell you right now. I'm on day three of food poisoning. Obviously, I'm not retching in pain as I was on day one, but things have not resolved. And so we're going to go for a little while in the fun half, and then it's going to be shortened. And I'm hoping that tomorrow I will be back and be 100%. More in the fun half. More details in the fun half.
A confluence of, as
oh my gosh, described. It really is nuts. But Matt, what's happening on the in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, tonight on Left Reckoning, we got two stories. We're gonna be talking about the Joe Manchin's daughter's EpiPen story, and also how she lied about having a master's in business from West Virginia University, and then apparently the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was told that they were wrong in that reporting, but then the subsequent investigation said that, nope, actually, it was lied, and people resigned at West Virginia University over the cover-up trying to force a business degree for this woman. So, I mean, West Virginia, I mean, we aren't talking about the Battle of Blair Mountain today. It's going to be for patrons, but West Virginia politics, pretty corrupt place. Joe was the governor at that time. That scandal happened, so.
That is a real coincidence.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about her and how they just decided they had this great plan with Pfizer. How about?
I wonder why that she did it from the West Virginia University as opposed to like one in a different state where her father wasn't governor.
Wasn't governor. Yeah, I know. It's probably harder to get fake master's degrees that way.
Boy, what a coincidence.
I'll also be talking about the Pfizer Mylan sort of, instead of Pfizer creating a competitor to EpiPens, they just combine with Mylan by one of the distributors, and then they just both reap the benefit of the monopoly.
Well, you know the old saying, which is, even if you can beat them, if you can corner the market and jack up the prices for something that's desperately needed, then you join them.
And Manchin's daughter, there's an email that she sent to Pfizer saying, oh, you're sure going to disinvest in this competitor, right? Because we have this agreement just explicitly saying that. So we'll be talking about that tonight. Also, Brian Muir of Telesaur, talking about Bolsonaro's little sort of rehearsal for a possible coup attempt.
Wait, that dude was the one who never responded.
I have him on Left Reckoning. So I guess we're exclusive with Brian.
All right, well, there you go. All right, folks, see you in the probably abbreviated fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back, back. Back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Africans are black, 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 black African, and the alpha males are black, 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 and the Africans are black, 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 black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.